You can have a French restaurant doing a braised oxtail and they can comfortably sell it for $42 to $50, right? And you would have oxtail prepared in, say, a traditional Jamaican fashion that would probably exceed it. And, you know, people would lose their minds if it was, you know, more than, I don't know, $15.
Hi, welcome to Black Tea. My name's Milena Williams.
And I'm Dalton Higgins.
And this is the last episode of our season, episode 8.
The last episode, egads. What happened? Hey, time flies when you're having fun, huh?
Yeah, and it's going to be a good one too, because we're talking about food.
Yes, I'm a foodie, you're a foodie, we're all foodies.
So our guest this week is Ryan Hinkson, and he's the curator of the Eat Famous Instagram account. He's one of Canada's most popular food influencers. He's amassed over 250,000 energetic and engaged followers, and his knack for creating eye-popping and impactful content has resulted in various viral hits. From creating the Eat Famous hashtag that has been used over 4 million times to his co-creation of Holy Chuck's Eat Famous Burger that has been viewed on Facebook over 20 million times, Ryan knows how to attract the right attention. The food industry has taken notice, and this has resulted in Ryan partnering and creating content for some of the largest brands on the planet. Ryan has worked with household names like McDonald's, Air Miles, Google, American Express, the Toronto Raptors, Hudson Bay Company, Domino's Pizza, Hershey Canada, A&W Wendy's, the LCBO, and many more. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate you guys.
So I love to eat. Dalton loves to eat. I mean, most people love to eat, but not everybody does what you do. So I was just wondering how you got into this. Like, do you love cooking? Do you just have a connection to food? How did it start?
I wish I had a more interesting story in terms of my relation to food prior to this. I mean, I had a high school job at Taco Bell making tacos, and I actually didn't cook for myself until I moved out for the very first time. I got really, really paranoid and probably spent like the last 2-3 months at home learning like all of my favorites that either my mom or my dad cooked. But fast forwarding, a good friend of mine, Terry Diaram, he had a business idea. And he had reached out to me because he knows I have a marketing background and a writing background. I used to write for a website called Trend Hunter. And he had stumbled across an article and told me that he needed someone to create some communication and marketing information around this business idea that he had, and also run some social media. At that point, I didn't even have a personal Facebook account. I didn't have any awareness of social, no experience or anything like that. So I had just kind of been introduced to Instagram, and I felt with the nature of what he was trying to do that it would just be a fitting platform to experiment with some branding. And my foray into creating food content on social was born that way. So through no grand design of my own, can't take any credit.
Yeah, totally. Now here's the thing. You know, I've seen you, I've been following you for quite some time because you post these like incredibly, these like quadruple layered meat patties, burgers, like this crazy stuff. Like, I'm just like, wow, it's a, and in fact, I think I DM'd you. I said, Ryan, yeah, we got to go eat. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we still do.
We got to do that, right? But here's the thing. Now, the one thing with you that why Mel and I were kind of like, it'd be awesome to have you on our show is, you know, it seems like as far as in the food space, right? We don't see a lot of black and racialized foodies out there, to be perfectly honest, to be blunt. Right. And you seem to be kind of, you know, it seems like racialized foodies seem to be getting organized. You know, I noticed there's all these alignments now. And so can we talk about that kind of, is there a bit of a movement happening as far as black and racialized foodies?
I think so. And the interesting thing is we've always existed, but I think we fall victim to what our people do in a lot of parts of life is we can exist without being seen. It's almost as if there's this perception that black people don't eat anything outside of patties or jerk chicken. And it's really crazy to me because I have friends, black friends, that have the most complicated, you know, coffee orders ever on the planet. But, you know, a Starbucks doesn't speak to that, or the assumption of like someone who wants a triple fat latte with foam could only be, for all intents and purposes, like a white girl, You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I tried, once the account really started to grow, I made it my mission not just to highlight what people of my own culture were doing, but I wanted to be very, very visible in all spaces, just so people understand that our interests are varied, our contributions to areas of the food industry that people don't assume that we contribute to are there, and they're very present, and they dictate culture and they dictate trends. I think, you know, with the kind of upswell of a refocus on racial injustice has always existed, but, you know, what we've seen in the last few months, and then being home and with people being forced to confront issues that they were able to kind of turn a blind eye to before, you're seeing a lot of brands, media reach out to these, you know, Black and people of color who are in the food space, who, like I said, it always existed, but it's now a situation where people want our take, or people want to show that we're being included. So we've always been there, but you're definitely right. The organizing, I think, is happening because we understand that, you know, people want to hear from us, and maybe their intentions aren't pure, or, you know, it was coaxed when it should have been natural. But while we've got this time to, you know, not only share what we do, but also our opinions and our voices and how it impacts us outside of just food.
And does that make you, because I know a lot of food influencers are like kind of anonymous, and they sort of let the food speak for itself. But
yeah,
does that make you kind of like know that you have to attach yourself to the brand to have that voice?
Yeah, I thought it was really important. I mean, there's a lot of incredible accounts that you've never seen the face of who's behind it. For myself personally, I felt like Eat Famous really, really started to grow when I did attach myself as the face of it. So it did exist as just a food-based account in its inception. So I wasn't on there. When Instagram rolled out stories, and when you had the capability to have a little bit longer video, that's when I decided that the only thing I had different going on, because with the food world, you see a lot of trends, and then everybody goes to the same restaurants and everybody's eating the same things, and everybody has access to the tips and tricks that can allow you to create really stellar content. So the only thing I felt like I had different was myself. And then through going to a lot of tastings and the events that were happening, being the only Black man in the room 9 times out of 10 or 9.5 times out of 10, I knew that I could capitalize on the fact that if I made myself the face of it, people would definitely remember me and they'd know me and it would stand out.
You made an interesting point, this idea of, yeah, we're out there, you know, influencing the culture, you know, across cultures. So it's not
right.
Like we, you know, because I happen to be a Black guy, Mel, a Black woman, that we singularly eat Caribbean cuisine. Like that's
right.
Not the case at all. You know, Mel and I, we eat across cultures. You know what I'm saying? Like, we'll
same.
Eat, you know what I mean? It doesn't matter what part of the world. We can, you know what I mean? We can get into it. Now here's the thing, though. Let's go into, Mel and I just happen to be of Caribbean descent, Caribbean background. And, you know, there are all these stories on the internet tied to customer service in Caribbean eateries. You know,
yeah.
You know, that may be a taboo subject, but we're going to go there. All right.
Right.
But I also have to but I have to put out a disclaimer here, right? In that in no way am I slamming Caribbean food eateries, restaurants. Hell no, because they oftentimes serve the best food in the city, bar none. Okay. And I will continue to eat at Caribbean eateries 24/7. That's not the point of this. But
right.
But it's interesting, like in Vice magazine a couple of years ago, they ran this story and it carried the title, you know, why the best Caribbean food comes with a side of bad service, all right? And the author was
wow.
pretty, yeah, and the author was pretty much was kind of saying what some of us kind of secretly feel. For example, yeah. You know, the author, you know, he said, like, for example, you know, when you walk in a Caribbean restaurant, you're greeted with his, you know, is way you want. You know what I mean? Is way you want,
right,
though, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
Which is like a Jamaican right. nation language translation that means, you know, what do you want, you know?
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about that without, like, pissing off, you know, Caribbean restaurant owners, you know? Like, because we're just
sure.
having some fun with this, right? Because, like I said, I'm going to eat there regardless. But, yeah, what's your take on that?
Oh, same. I mean, you know, we all deal with that in a cook yet, in already, that finish. Like, we know how it goes. But it's a testament to how incredible the cuisine is that, you know, you can put up with what might not be seen outside as the greatest service. And I mean, some things are cultural, though. They're innately understood by, like, I don't take offense. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I remember at a corporate job that I had introducing some friends to or colleagues, I should say, probably for the most part, to West Indian food, just because I was tired of like everybody else dictating the lunch runs. So I was like, no, you're gonna expand what we're eating, and everybody loved it. But you could see like the first few trips, the tension. You know what I mean? Like they wouldn't like order exactly what they want. They'd allow themselves to kind of be led out of fear. And to me, I'm laughing because it's hilarious. But again, like I said, a testament to how incredible our food is. I'm of Caribbean descent as well, mm-hmm. that, you know, they'll go and maybe even be a little uncomfortable. What I guess does concern me more so than those aspects, not that, you know, all cultures don't have a little bit of room to improve or things that are innate to us that maybe the broader, you know, people culturally don't get or they don't relate to.
Oh, customer service, but also poor customer service cuts across cultures as well. Yeah, that's part of like, that's for sure. I'm not going to name out other cultures. We're talking, you know, but yeah, that's for sure.
Hey, straight up, I have Chinese friends that they tell me if the workers are too nice at a certain Chinese restaurant, they don't anticipate good food. They feel like it's cover up.
Yeah, totally.
You know, so, but you know what I think does concern me more so than the service quotient, not that it couldn't be elevated, the interest or perhaps, access to some of the tech that's enhancing customer experiences or allowing people to discover you.
Okay.
You know, so, I mean, I go to restaurants in a variety of ways. I say that in terms of like, a lot of times restaurants reach out and ask me to come in, or I'm working with someone specifically, so I would go in, and then there's spots that I just want to go to because they're new and I want to check them out, and then there's spots I just love and I just want to go eat. And I may not announce that, you know, Eat Famous is coming through, but I generally still will take a couple of photos and will post them and share them on my social. And a lot of times the hope is, especially if I have a great experience at a West Indian restaurant or a Black owned and operated restaurant, is that if I'm tagging them and, you know, the post is getting a lot of traction, that somebody on the other end is going to respond. And I'm not talking about even setting up a financial transaction with me later, or for me to work with them on a paid basis, or even to thank me for blessing them with my presence, because that's not what I'm trying to do. But just the acknowledgement, just so they know they've got a supporter who can maybe drum up some more attention for them, who can produce some content. And that's, I guess, where I'm have more concern in terms of, to be honest, most other restaurants, if I go in and tag somebody, you know, there's a whole conversation that happens immediately after.
Yeah. You know, even to that point, though, but it's kind of like cultural. Some things, like, we know the work and time that goes into getting that, you know, that jerk chicken to taste just mm-hmm. right, or that mm-hmm. curry goat, or, you know, oxtail or whatever. So the authenticity is so hugely important that maybe sometimes some other aspects, and, you know, across cultures, I mean, we're just having this kind of fun conversation, but maybe it's just like, yeah, we just got to focus on the food, so that, you know, as opposed to, you know, when you go visit the restaurant and, you know, there's never any everything listed on the menu available, no matter what time of day you visit, you know, all those kinds mm-hmm. of things, right? So yeah, totally.
I remember a few years ago, when Chubby's opened, there was a bunch of controversy around it, not only because the owner was white, but I think they were quoted as to say, you know, characterizing it as the only place to get amazing Jamaican food when there's so much great Jamaican food in the city.
Yeah.
And it just, it was so interesting to me. But like, I also think there's this perception that like our food is fast food and it's not mm-hmm. fine dining. And I was just wondering if you could speak to that tension.
Of course. And I think, you know, it points right to experience and understanding. There's a lot of, you know, downgrading that kind of happens to, I guess, what would be described as cultural food. Mm. You know, it's funny because you can have a French restaurant doing a braised oxtail and they can comfortably sell it for $42 to $50, right? And you would have oxtail prepared in, say, a traditional Jamaican fashion that would probably, or, you know, rival it or exceed it. And, you know, people would lose their minds if it was, you know, more than, I don't know, $15, right? So I think the food and the way that it's prepared isn't the real issue. I think it's like perception of the culture. and the people, so that if, you know, we're doing it, or if somebody from that background is doing it, it's seen as, oh yeah, you know, it's fast or it's occasional, but it's not, you know, something worth spending a lot of money on, or it's not something I would have if I was having a big fancy dinner and I was trying to impress somebody. Even though there's real value and merit to the techniques that people are using, the manner in which it's prepared, just, because somebody isn't classically French trained or trained in a European style doesn't discredit their ability as a cook. So I think, you know, it's a real issue when we have that view of that type of food and cuisine.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even with that, do you want to even expand on that? Because here's the funny thing is, you know, when, again, you know, as foodies, you just eat, you know, so we're just right. Like, hey, we're going to eat, you know, when I was in Montreal just this past weekend, I ate at a Mexican food, like it was pretty every culture but my own culture, to be perfectly honest. So it's just food, but then people don't sort of look at, you know, they keep food and issues tied to race on separate islands, you know?
Yeah.
But I guess some of the new school, like, you know, foodies of your ilk, and there's a whole new crop of foodies that are just like saying, no, there's a connection. You know, we talk about issues around class, around, you know, maybe gender, race,
right. Yeah, and even food insecurity as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So what do you have to say to that? Yeah, this idea of just even talking about food and race, because to some people that might be weird, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, it exists. You walk into a restaurant, look at the difference generally between front of house and back of house. And front of house would mean, you know, like somebody who's a host or, you know, a waiter, someone that's serving you, that's seen by the customer, versus look at the racial makeup of people that are in the back of house, right? It starts there. So as soon as you enter the door, before we even talk about what the cuisine is and how it tastes, how good it is. So we have to have that conversation. It's unavoidable. Maybe, you know, in someone's perfect world, you should just be able to, you know, enjoy food and not worry about who's making it. But unfortunately, they're just truths that are uncomfortable and things that we do need to address and work through, because it bleeds past that for the people who may not be seeing career advancement. So you have a white chef and he's working with, I don't know, he's doing like a Neskovich fish or something, and he's seen as like groundbreaking or a trailblazer or, you know, willing to take risks. And then you have a chef of, say, Caribbean background who's doing an Italian dish, and, you know, they'll be called out for using a type of noodle that wouldn't go with that sauce. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's literally the same thing. Chef Adrian Forte, who is an incredible talent, and he was the first chef of color on Top Chef Canada just this past season. Mm-hmm. There was an episode where I believe it was Oxtail he was prepping, and one of the comments ahead of him presenting it or cooking it was like, oh, I'm sure it'll taste great, but I hope it's pretty, right? Mm-hmm. So why is the assumption that because the Jamaican chef is making oxtail, it's not going to look good? You know, and it's a provocative thing to hear, and it's an upsetting thing to hear. I know people that actually reached out to network and, you know, called them out on letting that air. And I feel two ways about that, because sometimes, you know, that you feel like that's irresponsible because there's no follow up or no lesson, unless, you know, you see him kill it and it's great, and then you draw your own assumptions. But also, you know, sometimes I feel like those little indiscretions, it's good for it to come out, because we have to question why people are saying that. Because I don't recall, and I watch it because I'm in the space, I watch a lot of food-based television, and those type of call-outs and microaggressions are generally reserved for Caribbean food.
Right, right, totally.
Or
yeah, it's rooted
food,
in,
I should say.
100%. Yeah, no, I totally get that. What, yeah. But even as far as, you know, so we all like to eat. That much is clear. Like what, you know, I've always wondered, like with foodies, you know, you're out at, you know, restaurants and checking out the scene, you know, different types of cuisine from across the globe, across, you know, 7 continents. Like how, like, what are you eating in your own household? You know what I mean? Like, what's going on? Like,
So the number one question I get when people meet me, especially for the first time, or they DM me, they're like, how are you not 300 pounds? So at home, it's salads, it's smoothies. I do intermittent fasting. That's one of the things about social media and Instagram, I guess, that a lot of us forget, is that it's controlled by the creator, right? I provide people with what I want them to see when I want them to see it. But there is a perception in this image that like everything I'm eating are these, you know, super indulgent, over the top meals, which I'm, when I'm out there doing it, do I eat it for real? Because I'm very against food waste and I don't want to perpetuate anything that's false. But I mean, you know, there's a lot of time I'm spending making sure that the right things go into my body. But I will say that a lot of the foodies that I met, myself included, you know, back a couple of years ago, we've all kind of expanded a little bit. We're filling up more of the frames on those pictures. So.
I forgot to ask this before, but can you give a little some details about the Holy Chuck burger that you created?
Yeah.
I love that place. So,
That was really, really, really fun. Holy Chuck is one of the first restaurants that I started to work with that allowed me access to their kitchen and to get really creative. And I was doing a takeover of a US-based Instagram account called Food Beast. They might be at 1 million followers now. I think at the time when I was doing a takeover for them, they were over 500,000. And at that time, those type of numbers were just not seen in the food space. So I was doing basically like a weekend in Toronto. So hitting a whole bunch of different spots in the city to give their audience a taste of Toronto. Dirty Bird, they had done like an oxtail poutine for me. So I was getting all the restaurants I was working with to do a special Eat Famous meal or Eat Famous item. So the owner of Holy Chuck, he came up with this burger where the buns were two deep fried wheels of brie cheese. There was patties, 8 pieces of bacon, like maple syrup. And I mean, it's just, looks like a mess, but it went crazy, like completely viral. I think that was the first thing that truly went viral. Right now, upwards of 20, 25 million views on Facebook alone. It was on UK Daily Mail that usually reports on like Meghan Markle and Prince Harry and the Kardashians. It was on the news in Japan. It was funny. Yeah. We had a dude drive down from Pennsylvania just to eat the burger. Cause it was just like a one-time thing created for this Food Beast takeover I was doing. And then Food Beast, they sent people down from the States to cover it. So it was definitely a good look. And I did have some of it. It was way too much to eat on my own. I think about 4 of us kind of cut it up and split it. But it was one of those things that, you know, it was obviously for the visual, but it actually tasted good. I know it might be hard. Believe, but yeah, that's another thing too. Cause you don't want to just do shock and awe and then there's nothing behind it. But, the Holy Chuck burger, I don't think I've eaten anything has been that crazy since.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned the words shock and awe. Yeah. And I think there are a couple posts on your, you know, gram or like, it's like a burger the size of your head, you know? And I was just like, I said, Ryan, how's Ryan eating this? You know, but there's a reason you have, you know, over 250,000 followers on Instagram. You know, we rely on you to kind of, you know, sort of point us to trends or new happenings or some real, you know, innovative, original kind of, takes on different styles of cuisine. So, I mean, we'd actually be remiss. I mean, are there any food trends happening right now, like in general, you know, because Mel and I will eat anything, man, like across culture, like, you know what I mean? Hot, sweet, sour, spicy, like what's going on out there as far as like, can even talk about Toronto if you'd like.
Yeah, so I've seen a melding of flavors and just things that ideally you wouldn't think would go together, but they work in terms of flavor profile and combining the right ingredients. I recently had a ice cream and fried chicken sandwich at Tokyo Hot Fried Chicken. And again, something that would probably sound crazy, but they use like a really, like a sweet brioche bun. There's hot honey, really, really crispy fried chicken. And then that French vanilla ice cream just kind of works. The main issue was like keeping it together because it's going to melt in a second, but if you go at it real quick. So I think you're seeing people meld things together that normally wouldn't go, but again, not just for the visuals, because you've just got a lot of these young chefs who are spending a lot of time learning, you know, what works in terms of combining flavors and switching things up. A big trend, though, that is not so much about the food, but more of a reaction to what we're going through in the world, i.e. COVID, is food that's being optimized for takeout. And the irony is, you had spoken to it earlier, is that, you know, Caribbean or Black food is seen as primarily takeout kind of food. But I mean, that's going to be the wave, right?
This works.
I feel like we're heading back towards probably, you know, some more restrictions in terms of how we can go out or eat and dine. And I think the takeout thing is going to be something that is with us and dominating the manner in which food is prepared and thought about for a while. And we're set up for that communally, you know, so that's good to see. So another great trend that I'm loving is we're seeing an influx of a lot of very, very talented, I don't know if I should describe them as home chefs, but just cooks who may not have a brick and mortar. They may not have a food truck, or they may actually do that, but they've this nice little pocket of people providing customized and in-home catering with just flavors that are just knocking you down. And I'm seeing a lot of Southern style foods. So like creamy mac and cheeses and fried chicken, fried shrimps paired with crab legs and lobsters. Recently, I have gotten some incredible food from Chop Time Catering. Their incredible Queen Bee Kitchen. She probably had the best candy DMs I've ever had in my life. Mr. Clutch Wings, that's a brother that is just doing crazy wings. They look like they've come off like a pterodactyl or something from the Flintstones. Like the size is just massive. They're huge. Home by Six, a young sister, Shania Chisholm, who's just doing really, really incredible work out of her kitchen. And the people who are well established, like Brian Butler, one of the founders of the Dirty Bird, he also has a catering company called Eat Blessed. And their food is, I remember I was at a birthday party the other day and it was catered and I didn't know that that's what they had, but I was so glad that I went to that party because it was one of the, it was like one of the first weeks after the COVID restrictions were kind of eased up and I was very tentative about going out. But when I saw that blessed tray, I was very thankful that I was there. So yeah, I think there's a lot of people that are realizing, especially with home delivery and COVID impacting, you know, people's willingness and ability to get outside, and they're coming to you or you can pick up. So that's a dope trend that I'm seeing. A lot of really talented Black cooks seem to be leading the charge. So that's, yeah, my favorite recent trend.
Thank you so much for joining us and sharing this information with us. It's so interesting.
No problem. Thanks for having me. It was a good time.
Welcome back to our tea segment. And we're going to be talking about something that I think initially we didn't really want to speak on it to not promote this person, but it's just impossible to ignore Tory Lanez.
Oh, yeah. He's spilling all kinds of tea over Brampton men's. Yeah.
He's ridiculous. I mean, it's such a terrible situation. But I'll just try to give some of the facts. Basically, I guess it was 2 months ago on July 12th, Megan Thee Stallion and Tory Lanez were involved in, there was a shooting and it later came out that he shot her twice in the foot and he hasn't said anything for 2 months and recently decided that he was going to not apologize, not make a statement, which he sort of alluded to on Twitter last Thursday night, but drop a mixtape saying he didn't do it.
Corny. What a cheese ball.
Right? I mean, I just feel like there's so many things he could have done to respond to the situation. And this is one of the worst things. I mean, in hip hop, I mean, how do you feel about it? Like, I feel like this is kind of unprecedented.
Yeah. How do I feel about it? Boy, I don't feel about it. I have no feelings left, you know, for Tory Lanez. I mean, the fact that he's using the shooting of Megan Thee Stallion to promote his new record, like, it's ridiculous. Actually, you know what I'd say? It doesn't surprise me in the least bit, right? Let me give you, I can give you just a little history. I mean, in Toronto, like, you know, it's almost like he's the king of the cheesy publicity stunt, right? Like, I remember years ago, mm-hmm. like I wrote a book about Drake, you know, the Drake phenomenon, like years ago. And and I remember, you know, in one of the chapters, I sort of talk about how he launched, like, this was back in like 2010, but he you know, there was a video on YouTube where he was sort of masquerading like he was Drake's little brother. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's this video that got uploaded and it was like, you know, Drake's little brother, Tory Lanez, does a freestyle. You know what I mean? And nobody knows if it was posted by him or his camp, but it created this rumor that Tory Lanez and Drake are related, you know, brothers. And everybody
so
says
he's always been a stunt king.
Oh, he's a stunt king. And then you know what he did that same year? He released a video to clarify that he was not Drake's little brother, and then he said, "Hey, I'll give Drake $10,000. Like he said, you know, I'll give Drake $10,000 if he actually listens to my music. You know what I mean? Like if he listens to my music, I'll give him $10,000. This is when Drake was coming up in the game. So he does all these cheesy little stunts that don't work most of the time.
Yeah, I remember, I think last year he was accused of making up a story about colorism on one of his music video sets.
Yeah.
People said that he sort of made up a story where there was some sort of like colorism with the women in the video, and he said he defended them, and then it came out that he might have been lying. So, I mean, he doesn't seem like the most honest person, but this is just so shameless and so abusive. Because he's basically spent the entire mixtape denying the shooting, which seems really bizarre because she already told us that it happened. There's proof that it happened. I believe there's medical records. And she said that it was him. So I can't believe he even has room to do this.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it was interesting too, while all of this is happening, you know, Megan Thee Stallion was recently named one of the most influential people in the world by Time Magazine, you know? So I think there's some credibility happening. There's no credibility issues there. Yeah.
And that makes it even worse because he's using her success and her trauma that he inflicted on her for his gain. It's disgusting. And it's just so weird because in the album, I mean, thank goodness I didn't have to listen to it. I just read about it, but he talks about, you know, still caring about her, but how could you care about somebody where you spent the entire project trying to gaslight her?
Yeah. I mean, he threw her under the bus, you know, throughout the you know, the mixtape, which I refuse to listen to, but I've seen on Genius, you know, the lyrics and people, it's been circulating quite frequently and rapidly on social media, you know, but this guy, but you know, Tory too, like I remember him, you know, in Toronto, like when he was here, because he had left Canada years ago, and you know, this guy's like a hustler, you know what I mean? Like he used to be that guy that you'd see selling those $5 mixtapes on street corners, you know, those, you know, back in the days when people used to have their mixtapes on, you know, dead Toronto's Eaton Center selling mixtapes and stuff. So that's what he used to do, because I remember seeing him. Oh yeah, yeah, he's hustling mixtapes on street corners. The guy's a hustler. There's no doubt about that.
So does he think this is going to work? I mean, there's obviously people that believe him because Megan's getting harassed in her Instagram comments. And it's like, I guess he's trying to find enough people to believe his story, which is incredibly dangerous. But like, I'm trying to figure out what his goal is. Is that it? Just to continue on as if nothing happened? And maintain his fan base. I don't understand.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's having
so abusive.
It's super abusive. I think it's having the opposite effect. You know, I think a lot of some of our woke friends and those are even a little less woke are going to, you know, stream Megan Thee Stallion's records. You know what I mean? They're just like, this is ridiculous. Like, I'm not going to stream this Daystar, his new mixtape. Like, this is outrageous, offensive. You know, so I think it's having the opposite effect. You know what I might do though, Mel? I think, you know, he won a couple Juno Awards these last few years, right? Like he's won Juno Awards, mm-hmm. best rap record, best R&B soul record in Canada. And, you know what I might do? Like what we should do is get, you know, go on change.org and set up get the petition happening to lobby, Karis, which is the Canadian Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, to revoke his awards, take his awards back.
They should.
Like, seriously.
They should. It's unbelievable. And I know that, and obviously, you know, in hip hop, there's a history of a lot of the time men entertainers, you know, there's abuse in the industry, there's misogyny running rampant through the industry, but have we ever seen somebody shoot someone else in the industry and then deny it and diss them through it? Like, it's just,
yeah, this is new.
It's gotta go.
This is some new territory. This is new, some new uncharted waters.
Like, no accountability, no regret. Like, But there was also these text messages that leak where he was apologizing to her and basically admitting to guilt. So it's just like, what?
Yeah, yeah. And he was framing it in around jealousy. He was saying they were dating, and then, you know, he was, I guess, interested in, was it Kylie Jenner, I believe? Yeah, yeah.
There was, he also started dissing people who were standing behind Megan, like, I believe Kalani and JoJo had taken him off their, like, these were their recent singles, so he dissed them. He dissed Chance the Rapper. I think he dissed J.R. Smith. Just anybody that's supporting Megan, which is just like, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
You're a scumbag.
Total scumbag. He is yet to be charged with any crime, you know, and the investigation is ongoing. But in the court of public opinion, he's guilty as charged. Breonna Taylor's are still running free. So yeah, this is really the criminal justice system. It needs to, you know, get working. It's not working.
It's really upsetting to see that this could happen to a black woman, and she could say that it happened. There's proof over and over again, and there's still room for the man to say, oh, well, no, it didn't. And people are actually saying, you know, there's two sides to every story. It's just so dangerous.
Yeah, yeah. It's super disappointing. I mean, or am I disappointed? Absolutely. You know, am I surprised at the outcome of him putting out a mixtape? This, you know, the same guy who allegedly claimed to be Drake's brother to get attention to his product. No, I'm not surprised.
I don't know what it's going to take for people to just say enough is enough.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to take perhaps the dirty criminal words, criminal charges. You know, that's what it's going to take, you know?
He's got to go.
Yeah. Ditto. I second that notion. I third that notion. Well, we want to thank you, the listener, for checking out another episode, the last episode of season 2, the Black Tea Podcast. I'd love to thank my co-conspirator, my partner in crime, my partner in rhyme, Malena Williams. You can find Malena at Malena Williams on Twitter. You can find me at Dalton Higgins 5 across socials, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. And of course, I would be remiss if I didn't thank our super producer. He goes by the name of Ryan Clark. So last but not least, I want to thank our sponsor, Fido. You know, if not for Fido's support, this show would not be what it is. All right. So thank you all. And we look forward to connecting with you all on socials. And subscribe. Peace out.